I have a lot of friends who are in the field of Old Testament. I did make a point of telling them all that Walter Brueggemann was coming to Wesley Seminary. And as soon as you say Walter Brueggemann to somebody in the field of Old Testament, you know what they do? They shake their heads. They just shake their heads. I don't think there's anybody in the field today who is as prolific a writer as Brueggemann or as widely read. And he's not just read by people in his own field. He's read by a lot of people in the church, by seminarians, by lay people, because he has something very important to say to all of us. He is a professor of Old Testament at Eden Seminary in St. Louis, Missouri. He is a native of the Midwestern part of the United States. He was educated at Elmhurst College in Chicago. He went to seminary at Eden Seminary in St. Louis. He took a PhD at Union Theological Seminary in New York City, where he studied with James Meilenberg, and a PhD in education, which he got at the at St. Louis University. He's married to a United Church of Christ pastor and has two sons. He is the author, as I have said, of many, many books. The newest one that I have seen is called David's Truth in Israel's Imagination and Memory. Many of you have read another title by him, The Prophetic Imagination, a book called The Creative Word, which is about the Bible in Christian education, The Bible Makes Sense, The Land, Living Toward a Vision, two new books on the Psalms, and my favorite book, an old one, called The Vitality of the Old Testament Traditions. Every seminarian at Wesley knows that in order to get out of this place, you have to have a method. Remember that? For your CIM paper, or your master's thesis, or whatever it may be. This little book, The Vitality of the Old Testament Traditions, provided me with my method, and I will be everlastingly grateful. The only other thing I have to say about Professor Brueggemann before I turn the microphone over to him is that he reported to me that he was very interested in baseball until last night.
One of the perks of being invited to Wesley is getting to have dinner with Dr. Moss. I am delighted to be here. This is my first time at Wesley. Of course, I know about Wesley. I know about Wesley primarily because I think that Bruce Birch and I are sort of up to the same things. But I am, in any case, delighted and honored to be here for this lectureship. Unless I abbreviate it, this is a rather long lecture. I may be able to cut parts of it, and I shall set the stage for about 90% of the lecture in order to make two points at the end that I hope will be important points to you. I assume we will have some time for some conversation afterwards. What I want to talk about is the probe that is now going on about how to organize Old Testament theology, or as Dr. Moss would say, how to find a method. It is now clear that the method of Eichrote to reduce everything to a single theme, or the method of Von Rod to recite the tradition, will no longer be adequate. Many scholars now propose dealing with the Old Testament in a bipolar scheme. My own proposal in two recent articles in the Catholic Biblical Quarterly suggests that one pole should be the legitimization of structure. That's what the Old Testament does, whether that structure is moral, theological, social, political, or economic. And the other pole should be labeled the embrace of pain. This second pole reflects the anguished recognition that no legitimization of structure fully takes into account the specificity, the immediacy, the harshness of pain as it is experienced by those who are not fully valued by the legitimated structure. I have argued that this tension between the legitimization of structure and the embrace of pain is at the core of the Old Testament, that this tension is definitional for Israel's understanding of God, for Israel's characterization of human persons, and for Israel's strategy for organizing public life. I want to try to pursue these themes in more detail now. The beginning point is to say that Old Testament faith is vigorously and actively aniconic. That means it won't accept images. The God of Israel will not be represented in any visible, manageable form. Von Rod, Zimmerle, and Schmidt have shown that the first two commandments of the Decalogue are at the very heart of Israel's understanding of God. This God will not be accompanied by any other divine agent, will claim full allegiance, and will share that loyalty with none other. This God must not be articulated in any fixed, stable, predictable form, because this God is free and unencumbered. Now, that does not mean that God has no form. Obviously, the Bible knows that God has eye, ear, hand, heart, and all of the rest. It only means that God will not be seen. Indeed, even Moses gets to see not God's face, but God's back, which students say is the first theological case of mooning. In Deuteronomy 4, which is a report on Sinai, it is clear that it is a meeting with a voice and not with a form. The voice announces commandments, which says that Yahweh will command and Israel will obey. That images are precluded, there is no form, means that Israel can never manage God. Now, this business of Yahweh being aniconic can be played out this way. First, that Yahweh is an inscrutable newness in the history of religion. The Old Testament does not ask metaphysical questions, but deals with historical memories. We doing all right on sound? Or is that too loud? Too loud. Thank you. So that if one looks at J or P, particularly in Exodus 3 or Exodus 6, it is clear that Israel is concerned to understand how Yahweh first appeared and how Yahweh got known. So that J wants to pretend that Yahweh was always known from creation, and P is much more sophisticated to argue that Yahweh was not known until Moses and the burning bush. Either way, this new God created new historical possibilities for Abraham and Sarah and the community of Moses. Second, that Yahweh's aniconic character is articulated with reference to the other gods. The language of Yahweh's character and self-presentation is political in its tone and its implications. Thus, the first commandment, "There will be no other gods before me," means that the throne room of Yahweh will brook no rival and entertain no alliance. And this resolve of Yahweh is carried out in the narrative. So, for example, in Exodus 14, Yahweh asserts, "I will get glory over Pharaoh," that is, the acquiring of sovereign splendor comes by the defeat of the Egyptian gods who are clustered around Pharaoh. And in 2nd Isaiah, where Yahweh is in conflict with Babylonian gods, in Isaiah 42 and 48, Yahweh says, "My glory I will share with no other." Yahweh will not share Yahweh's glory with Babylonian gods, nor political authority with Babylonian authority. Thus, at the two pivot points, with Egyptian power in the early period and Babylonian power in the late period, Yahweh will not traffic with the other gods or be allied with the empire. Thirdly, Yahweh is unencumbered by reference to the other gods, unallied with other gods, rejecting the power of the empire. And the stunning outcome of Yahweh's aniconic character leads to a surprising therefore. Whenever you see a therefore in the Old Testament, look out, because something's about to happen. The therefore is remarkable and unexpected and inscrutable. The therefore is that Yahweh is engaged with the marginal ones who go by the name of Yahweh. Yahweh's foundational characteristic is that having an imageless identity makes Yahweh available for and attentive to those who do not participate in the image-making, image-enhancing, image-producing, image-consuming ways of imperial life. This is nowhere stated more clearly than in Psalm 82, which is a theologically primitive poem in which the gods are on trial and the poem makes an announcement about the new notion of godness. The ancient Near East, along with the Reader's Digest, had assumed that godness consists in omniscience, omnipotence, and omnipresence. But in Psalm 82, Yahweh announces afresh what it means to be God, and it is not a hymnic statement of order, as the gods of the empire might spout, but it is an imperative that says, this is what makes you a God. Give justice to the weak and fatherless. Maintain the right of the afflicted and the destitute. Rescue the weak and the needy. Deliver them from the hand of the wicked. And in the Song of Moses in Exodus 15, the hymn asks doxologically, who is as Yahweh? And the liturgical response is, nobody. But the hymn not only asserts Yahweh's incomparability, it specifies this incomparability as Yahweh being the one who opposes Pharaoh and all theological claims of the empire. The power of this aniconic God is mobilized for the slave community against the claims of the empire. To be imageless is the other side of Yahweh's propensity to be allied with those who are excluded from the safe, privileged world of religious image. Because gold and silver are the stuff of images, Yahweh disassociates Yahweh's self from all accumulations of silver and gold, that is, from all monopolies of religious aggrandizement. What the Bible asserts at its foundation is that Yahweh's monopoly of glory is the cause of Yahweh's attentiveness to marginality, and these are twin aspects of Yahweh's aniconic identity. This God announces a new decision for a new habitat, that Yahweh will dwell on high, and Yahweh will dwell with the lowly, but Yahweh will not dwell in the big house with Pharaoh. Now, this aniconic character of Yahweh cannot be contained in purely religious categories, and that is a primary mistake of much scripture interpretation. The aniconic God lives in tension with the gods of the empire, but the counterpart which is definitional for the Old Testament is that Israel models, constructs, and advocates an ordering of human community which is also aniconic. That is, Israel as a social community refuses to assign to any visible structure, form, or symbolization the power of holiness or the power for life. An imageless God accompanies a social vision and a social practice of equality and justice. The aniconic claims of Israel's faith cannot be contained in heaven, but characteristically spill over and insist upon the practice of justice in the earth. The radical social vision of the Old Testament is not an invention of the prophets, but is already contained in Israel's primal discernment of God, who wanted the people who were enslaved by the empire let go. So what I'm arguing is this inalienable connection between the character of God and the shape of the community. That is why our doctrine of God is so important, is because it contains the strategies and modes of social organization. So in Exodus 2 and 3, at the center of that text is the theophanic report of the burning bush, in which Yahweh is disclosed as an imageless, holy presence. But the burning bush narrative is set in a very particular context, just before it Moses had committed a dangerous act of violence by killing an Egyptian. And in Moses' act of killing the Egyptian, Moses delegitimates the claims of the empire. We, no doubt, would call it an act of terrorism. But it is, in fact, a dismantling of the authority of the empire. And at the end of Exodus 2, when Pharaoh dies, Israel cries out. Because whenever emperors die, slaves hope. That hope comes in the form of cries and groans when Israel recovers for a moment its voice of pain and hope. And the marvelous thing about it is that that voice of pain and hope evokes Yahweh. So I submit that it is the violent act of Moses and the hopeful groan of Israel that are the context of the theophany of the burning bush. And the burning bush episode in Exodus 3 is followed by a credo-like promise in the mouth of Yahweh, who has come down in order to give freedom, so that it is God's freedom in the bush which is translated to Israel's freedom in the earth. Yahweh is engaged in a radical social practice which creates an alternative social possibility. What we have called the P tradition in Exodus 14 says that Yahweh would get glory over Pharaoh. What we have called the J tradition has Yahweh say, "Let my people go." But the two statements, "I will get glory," and "let my people go," are essentially synonymous. Letting my people go is the way Yahweh gets glory. Now, that social vision that derives from the character of Yahweh is played out in the Decalogue, which, as you know, begins with the first two commandments that are aniconic, but it ends with the 10th commandment. I never understand how Lutherans count them. They count them differently. But the 10th commandment, "You shall not covet." Now it is argued by scholars with whom I agree that the 10th commandment, that is, make it right, the 10th commandment is not a general statement about envy and jealousy and greed, but it is rather a statement about land tenure policy. So you shall not covet your neighbor's field, and you shall not cover your neighbor's house. Gottwald and Cheney and Coote and others have argued that ancient Israel was essentially an attempt at a revolutionary land tenure system that had important implications for the relationship between peasant and urban dweller, between the power of taxation and the practice of land grants. We know from the Joseph narrative of Genesis 47 and the story of Naboth's vineyard in 1 Kings 21 that there was land policy that presumed that all land finally belonged to the throne. Israel is enormously suspicious of such land policy. And the reason I stress this is that I have the deep conviction that almost all of the great social troubles in the world are about land policy. Even in curriculum revision, they are about land policy. But what the Bible knows about Yahweh is that Yahweh has no interest in or need for a monopoly. Yahweh is not a land grabber. And so one of the great texts in the Bible has Yahweh say in Psalm 50, "I will accept no bull from your house." Which means, I was taught that in Psalms, and my students have now given me a rubber stamp with that on it that I use on term papers. But the point of it is that Yahweh has no interest in craving territory or goods, that Yahweh does not practice social monopoly, and Yahweh does not permit anybody else to practice social monopoly. So the laws of the Torah are an attempt to develop social practice and organize social institutions that are resonant with Yahweh's an iconic character. Paul Hansen and Fernando Bilo have shown that not all of the laws are inclined to such a transformative vision, but those that seem most faithful to Yahweh's radical self-disclosure are indeed expressive of such a transformative vision. Thus, the law implements as social policy and social practice this articulation of God, who is against all images in heaven and on earth. And I expect that the most radical and iconic teaching as concerns social organization is the Law of Jubilee in Leviticus 25, which I understand as an egalitarian practice, as a mode of Yahweh's an iconic rule, in which it is announced in verse 23, Leviticus 25, 23, that the land is mine, and therefore it cannot be controlled and administered by an empire. And secondly, that they are my servants, and they shall not be sold as slaves. This God aims at two social practices of keeping land out of the hands of the rapacious and of keeping people out of the service of the abusive. Yahweh's refusal to covet permits Israel to order its life according to land policies which are free of coveting. That's first part. Second point. Obviously, the Old Testament did not remain untouched by iconic temptation. Now, by iconic, I do not mean to speak about having God in an image, because that does not happen in the Old Testament. The iconic inclination, however, should not be interpreted simply as the making of images, but simply as the desire to locate and identify and fix and control God. They did not want to see God literally, but they wanted to know where God would be in order that they could count on God. I want to suggest three texts about this iconic temptation. The most obvious reference is the narrative of the golden calf in Exodus 32. As you know, Aaron makes a calf. Yahweh and Moses discuss the calf. Moses and Aaron discuss the calf. And Moses summons, discuss is a wonderful neutral word. And Moses summons the Levites to act in judgment to purge the evil. It is clear in this narrative that the Levites are understood as the faithful who are instructed to smash the iconic. And it is equally clear in this partisan narrative that the well-pedigreed Aaron, who is the leader of an elitist priesthood, is responsible for the reality of the calf. The actual commentary about the calf is interesting. Aaron said to them, "Take off the rings of gold which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me." I didn't realize till I read this, and I must send it to my son at Earlham. This shows that boys wore earrings a long time ago. So all the people took off the rings of gold which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And Moses explains his action to Moses. "I said to them, let any who have gold take it off. So they gave it to me, and I threw it in the fire, and there came out a calf." Observe, the temptation to iconic religion is linked to the reality of gold. This community is no longer the desperate one that sneaks out of Egypt with a little bit of gold in Exodus 11. Now it is a community with established gold and jewelry, and this confiscated gold is evidence of an economic surplus. So I am urging that the implementation of the iconic tendency by Aaron is correlated to the economic situation which makes gold possible and available. Second, it can be and has been argued by many scholars that the Temple of Solomon is essentially iconic, that it is built to fix God. So as you know, in 2 Samuel 7, David has this dream about building a house for Yahweh, and it's interesting that he only thinks of it after he's got his own stuff settled. The fact that David has situated himself in a house of cedar shows that iconic tendencies occur when there is surplus value that can help make God into a patron. It is clear that the debate that follows between Nathan and David reflects a struggle for the heart of Israel. There is approval for the temple, but then there is a retraction of that approval for the sake of Yahweh's freedom to come and go. This debate over the temple is tension over the character of God. And I mean to be arguing that this tension occurs in the very character of God, that Yahweh really wants a temple and doesn't want a temple, because Yahweh is in the midst of deciding what kind of a God Yahweh will be. Thirdly, that tension is expressed in 1 Kings 8, the text that I will use in chapel tomorrow, so I'm not going to exegete that tonight, but save it for tomorrow. But it is obvious that 1 Kings 8 is an intense debate about the presence of God in the temple. In all three texts, Exodus 32, 2 Samuel 7, and 1 Kings 8, there is a push in Israel to get God located. In each case, the attempt to locate God is linked to economic affluence. In Exodus 32, it is the gold of Aaron. In 2 Samuel 7, it is the cedar of David, and in 1 Kings 8, it is the opulence of Solomon. And in each case, the economic surplus that leads to the image or the location is criticized and rejected. So in Exodus 32, Moses rejects the calf. In 2 Samuel 7, Nathan rejects the temple. And in 1 Kings 8, there is a questioning of God's presence in the temple. There were voices in Israel who were prepared to present faith in Yahweh as a faith that was on its way to the iconic. Now, the point that I wish to make about that is that iconic religion always carries with it social policy that leads to social monopoly for the affluent. Israel's primal commitment out of Exodus and Sinai is an iconic faith and egalitarian society. But what Israel learned through the generations is that it is exceedingly difficult to maintain an iconic faith and egalitarian society. It is difficult to maintain not because Israel was pressured from outside, but because of what was happening in Israel's own life. As Israel became securely established, former slaves became masters, peasants became managers of surplus value, and the yearning for a locatable God was accompanied by a modified social policy and practice which legitimated social distinctions, stratified politics, and differentiated economic advantage. I will cite two texts to show how the iconic led to social monopoly. First, in Judges 8, verses 22 to 28, Gideon is invited to become king. It is a much-cited text, and it is celebrated that Gideon refused the monarchy and said, "No, Yahweh should be king. I won't be king." That was a noble gesture. But what is often not noticed is that Gideon goes on this way, "I will not rule over you. My son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you." And Gideon said to them, "But let me make one request of you. Give me, every man of you, the earrings of his spoil." And they answered, "We will willingly give them." And they spread a garment, and every man cast in it the earrings of his spoil, and the weight of the golden earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, besides the crescents and the pendants and the purple garments worked by the kings of Midian, besides the collars that were about the necks of the camels. They brought a lot of stuff to Gideon. We should be astonished that this community, which we imagine to be primitive in the book of Judges, had such a deposit of gold. We should be further astonished that Gideon had the chutzpah to ask for it for himself. And we should finally be astonished that Israel willingly complied. In the Hebrew, it is an infinitive absolute, which means really willingly. This narrative suggests that there were some important things going on in Israel, and it is interesting how it juxtaposes Gideon's refusal of kingship and Gideon's readiness for gold. Presumably, problems are easier to spot which are political temptation than those which are economic temptation. And you can check it out in mainline liberal Protestantism like Methodist and United Church of Christ that we are able to make all kinds of radical political pronouncements, but we have a tough time when it comes to economics. So did Gideon. The second text, one more time, Solomon. There is no doubt that Solomon established economic monopoly and a temple monopoly for Yahweh. And the thesis that I mean to propose is simply, not a new thesis, that Solomon's temple legitimated social oppression. There is, first of all, forced labor, which we call the draft. And it does not really matter whether Israel was drafted along with the others or not. The most amazing thing about it is that it could be instituted as political policy in Israel without anybody questioning it. Second, in 1 Kings 4, there is the report of an elaborate royal bureaucracy and an elaborate tax collecting system. An enormous tax collecting system always means a governmental legitimization for the practice of social inequality. That's what taxation is all about. Well, we can talk about it. Thirdly, in the two chapters at the end of the Solomonic narrative, in 1 Kings 11 and 12, it is reported that Solomon followed the foreign gods of his foreign wives. Second, that there was a warning of judgment directly from the Lord. Thirdly, that there were two rebellions of people that he had oppressed. Fourthly, there is subversive activity on the part of the prophet Ahijah. And fifthly, there is a negotiation with Rehoboam that tries to negotiate the oppressiveness, and Rehoboam won't yield. The picture traced in these two chapters of Solomon and Solomon's regime and Solomon's son Rehoboam is of an Israel that has lost its way, forgotten the Exodus, and perverted Yahweh, foreign gods, political rebellion, prophetic denunciation, and Rehoboam's response is that I will use heavier yoke than my father, and I will use whips. Iconic religion leads to social oppressiveness and a peculiar absence of sensitivity and compassion. So, I am suggesting then to organize Old Testament theology around one pole that is an iconic religion that leads to egalitarian social practice, and the other pole, iconic religion that leads to monopolistic social practice. The first pair is established in the structure of the Decalogue, that starts out no other gods and that ends there shall be no coveting. The second pair is not so nicely articulated, but I submit to you that it is there, because the royal temple practices that deny Yahweh freedom are also the practices that lead to the accumulation of silver and gold, and the social system finally matches the notion that Yahweh is patron. Now, this tension between the aniconic and the iconic, between egalitarian and monopolistic social practice, is articulated in a variety of ways among scholars, so that Tyrian has referred to the ethical ear and the contemplative eye. James Sanders has spoken of the critical and the constitutive. Klaus Westermann has spoken of deliverance and blessing. Paul Hansen has spoken of visionary and pragmatic, reformative and formative, teleological and cosmic. Levinson has spoken of Sinai and David. Belo has spoken of debt cancellation and purity. I regard all of these word pairs as various attempts to talk about the same thing. But the critical point that I want to make is this, that almost without exception, Belo would be an important exception, Scholars have identified the two poles of Old Testament theology and simply said that they are both there and we must honor them both. It is about that I wish to raise questions. The reason I believe that the two poles cannot simply be set there as though they were equal partners goes like this. First, that the two poles of aniconic egalitarian and iconic monopolistic reflect very different sociologies of the have-nots and the haves. And the reading of every theological text requires socio-theological alertness, if not suspicion. How one articulates that tension matters enormously for the role of biblical faith in contemporary society. Second, the polarity does not only address economics of having and not having, but it really yields a broad view of social reality, about whether social reality is to be understood in terms of transformative categories and egalitarian practice, or whether Yahweh is essentially a conserver of present cultural arrangements and values. If that be the normative claim, then society is celebrated as a viable arrangement in which problems are to be contained within the limits of the system. Thirdly, it can be argued that the first pole of the aniconic is what is distinctly Israelite, whereas the other pole of the iconic has most in common with other Near Eastern religions. That is, Israel is at its most radical when it is unlike its neighbors and is least radical when it imitates its neighbors in the practice of iconic religion and social monopoly. Fourth, this is a bit of a hazardous point, but I suggest that in the Torah, that is the first five books, the tradition of transformation is dominant, and the royal traditions come only later in the second canon of the prophetic literature and are surely subordinated in authority. Now, this canonical preference for the aniconic is not complete, and it is mitigated by the presence of creation theology and priestly legislation in the Torah. But I would suggest that the central dynamic of the Torah concerns transformation and not equilibrium. And that is why regularly on Passover, Jews do not go back to creation texts, but they go back to the Exodus and next year in Jerusalem. That is, the Jewish tradition provides a clue about how to weigh these matters. Now, I want to suggest that this way of understanding Old Testament theology, according to these two poles, is to be best understood in contrast to three other hypotheses about how to organize. The first, which is largely rejected by scholars, but which exercises enormous influence in all church libraries that I know, is that Old Testament religion is understood in developmental or evolutionary terms. Just amazing how many books every church library has got that interprets it that way, that the religion gets better and better and better until you finally arrive at Jesus. That hypothesis surely has to be rejected, and those books need to be removed. Because it is clear that Yahweh did not evolve, but that Yahweh intruded abruptly in the slave camps of the empire and came from nowhere. And Gottwald has argued to my satisfaction that Israel did not evolve, but Israel appeared abruptly in the slave camps when they found their voice of pain and hope. So it is not simply a matter of getting free of 19th century evolutionism. It is a matter of recognizing the radical break that is caused by the presence of Yahweh and the appearance of Israel in the history of the world. Second, that the credo hypothesis of von Rad, Deuteronomy 26 and Wandering Arameans and all of that, is still enormously attractive. And the reason it is enormously attractive is that von Rad was seeking a way to study scripture that would echo the claims of the Barmen Declaration and the way in which the confessing church in Germany could find standing ground against an oppressor. The power of the credo hypothesis is found in the congruence between that theological crisis in Germany and the practice of Old Testament faith in the face of Egyptian, Canaanite, Assyrian, and Babylonian oppression. And von Rad and his colleagues understood the analogy. Gottwald has taken von Rad's hypothesis and has handled it so that there is much more sophisticated social practice in Gottwald than there was in von Rad. He has introduced a dimension of critical analysis that has changed the terms of the conversation. The credo now cannot be presented simply as a recital of faith, which it is, but must be understood as an act of revolutionary social practice that embodied the social construction of the Torah. That means that Gottwald has moved us beyond to find a center in Old Testament theology. That attempt was made most clear by Eichrodt, who organized everything around the covenant. It is now clear that the Bible cannot be organized around a single theme, for we will inevitably engage in reductionism in order to do that. Two recent attempts need comment. They are pretty good, but they are problematic, I think. First, Sam Terian, who is my teacher, in his elegant book, The Elusive Presence, has tried to organize biblical theology around the notion of God's presence. The problem with Terian's effort, I believe, is that it yields a kind of transcendentalism because Terian does not seem to notice that every articulation of God's presence is inevitably a comment on social reality and social practice. And every pastor ought to know that before she issues a call to worship on Sunday morning. Every statement about God's presence bootlegs a statement about social power. The other recent effort is by Rolf Knirum, who has proposed that the Bible be organized around the theme of the righteousness of God, and that has a great deal to commend it, but my reading of Knirum suggests that he does not notice when righteousness is handled in a conserving way and when it is handled in a transformative way, and so we are back again at the two poles. Now, I want to suggest that the reason we have got to organize the Bible around these tensions and conflicts is that that's the world we live in. It does not take a Marxist analysis to notice that the world is largely organized in a conflict between the haves and the have-nots. And therefore, I do not suggest that organizing Old Testament theology in this way is an absolute truth for all time, but I suggest that it is a way of organizing the material that is peculiarly appropriate to the moment of faithfulness in which we find ourselves. Now that leads me to the question that I want to deal with. If the Old Testament, as I have argued, represents the poles of transformation and conservation, around the poles of legitimization of structure and embrace of pain, around iconic and aniconic discernments of God, the question is, how are we to adjudicate the relative authority and importance of these two trajectories? And I want to make two kinds of responses. First, how these two tendencies are adjudicated seems to me to depend completely on whose one dialogue partners are. The text is heard differently depending on who's in the room when you exegete it. That's why it's important for theological faculties, even if they are tokens, as they are in many schools, to have blacks and women and other minority groups on the faculty, because it changes the conversation. The voices of liberation theology do not object to being charged with contextualization, that is, they freely admit that they are advocates of the poor. If the same admission of contextuality is conceded for Euro-American interpretation, which characteristically speaks as legitimators of the established social interest, it is clear that all interpretations are shaped and determined by the voices present in the conversation. How one credits traditions of theology and social practice depends on one's conversation partners. It will not do to imagine that scripture interpretation is objective. Elizabeth Schuster Fiorenza's last book makes that so clear. That we need first to notice and acknowledge the operation and importance of conversation partners, and second, to assess critically if these particular conversation partners are agents of distortion or if they help us discern rightly and faithfully. Second, in the adjudication of dialogue partners, it is important to try to clarify who the proper partners are on the assumption that not just any conversation partner is as valid as any other. It must be clear that the choice of dialogue partners is not an arbitrary choice or a personal preference, but the choice of dialogue partners must be appropriate to the material itself, thus the hermeneutical circle. On the one hand, the identity of the partner determines the character of the text. On the other hand, the character of the text is decisive for choosing the partner. The point has been argued by Barth when he insisted that the object of theology, by which he means God, is determinative for the method and not vice versa, as he believed had become the case since the Enlightenment and Schleiermacher. I argue in similar fashion that a responsible critical method requires dialogue partners that are appropriate to the subject itself, that the community of interpretation must be congruent with the God of the text and the perspective on reality offered by the text. So the decision I make in that hermeneutical circle is this: first, that the interpretive community must be primarily concerned for justice and not equilibrium, because the God of the text is primarily concerned for justice. Second, that the interpretive community must be in alert and suspicious dialogue with the great political empires, because the text itself stands largely in contradiction to the great empires, Egyptian, Assyrian, Babylonian, Persian, and Hellenistic. The text presents those empires as systems of legitimization, technology, methodology, ideology, epistemology that serve order and not justice. Third, that the interpretive community must be in tension with the great comprehensive religious systems, because the text itself is characteristically in tension with the Canaanite, Babylonian, and Hellenistic religious systems. Those great religious systems, which are characteristically iconic, create the kinds of images that offer the false and seductive promise that humankind can secure its own existence. Israel and its text are persistently in tension, if not in conflict, with the notion that of any religion that imagines it can secure its own existence. Fourth, the interpretive community must be committed to a scandal in the face of imperial alternatives of order and religious alternatives of security, because this text and its God practice such a scandal against just such systemic order and comprehensive security. The scandal is that the text is image rejecting because of the holy, jealous God who will fit into no preconceived scheme of divinity. Now, I have already conceded that this way of adjudicating the iconic and the aniconic is not unambiguous, and that it finally depends on a hermeneutical decision. That hermeneutical decision, however, is not subjective and arbitrary, but is informed by the text at hand. So the urging I make is that the God of the Old Testament is fundamentally aniconic, and the social practice that is derived from, referred to, and authorized by this God is a social practice of the aniconic, that is, a refusal of oppressive social relationships and a refusal of economic political monopoly, and therefore a social practice of egalitarianism. Therefore, the appropriate conversation partners are those who can honor that aniconic character, who are capable of suspicion about the gods in heaven and the powers on earth, and who are prepared to engage in criticism both of the gods and of the socioeconomic derivations from those gods. This conclusion is drawn in response to one simple question: with whom does the God of the Bible make a regular abode? To whom does this God regularly attend? And the answer is that the God of the Old Testament has taken as primary partner in the conversation of history the poor, the needy, the mixed multitude, the disestablished swarm, whom Gottwald has called peasants and whom the Credo tradition names as slaves. The aniconic God regularly finds conversation partners among the socially marginal, and therefore the interpretive task must be carried on with and in the presence of the socially marginal and the politically vulnerable, the ones of broken spirit and contrite heart, because they are the ones congenial to this subject matter of the interpretive conversation. A New Testament extrapolation from this conclusion is that the aniconic character of God is embodied in the suffering crucified Jesus, whose best friends were publicans and sinners and the crowd who hung on his words. It is therefore the tradition of suspicion which belongs with the interpretive task, suspicion that is not only theological but socio-political and psychological as well. This suggests that in our recent intellectual history, the aniconic contributions of Freud and Marx loom large for our work. It matters enormously who is included in the conversation. Such a conversation as the Bible offers emerges among barren women, unhealed persons, hungry crowds, oppressed slaves, homeless sojourners, ritually disqualified lepers, a conversation which leads to a theology of the cross. An alternative conversation could lead with iconic premises to a theology of glory, but that is a conversation incongruent with the God who hears the cries of the poor, assaults the structures of the empire, and finally frees slaves. Now finally, I want to cite two important aspects of that aniconic conversation that are going on among us, which I regard as exceedingly important. First, I regard the American Roman Catholic bishops' letters on nuclear arms and economics as among the most important religious events of our time, because the bishops now have asserted the profound tension that exists between the claims of the gospel and the iconic values and policies of the American system. Indeed, the response of officialdom, that means Michael Novak, to the two letters indicates that the letters are perceived as theologically and socially aniconic, that is, as acts which delegitimate the sustaining symbols of the system. The letters are a critical and crucial declaration that God is not located in the theological claims and pretensions that legitimate monopoly in politics and economics. Second, I regard the conversations that Leonardo Boff is having with church authority as exceedingly important in this matter. Boff's daring use of the categories of production and consumption in relationship to the Eucharist and the monopoly of administrative power over the sacraments as a means of production and consumption has been inevitably and predictably misunderstood. It is clear that Boff's primary theological partners are those who have no access to the production of the Eucharist and who are voiceless in its consumption. What I regard as the mistaken response to Boff is predictably iconic. The categories of production and consumption, it was asserted, are not applicable because the sacrament is a gift from heaven. Of course, the practitioners of iconic religion, who are invariably practitioners of social monopoly, shrink from aniconic criticism because such criticism in a theological mode always assaults the monopoly of power and goods. I suggest then that for our situation, the questions of Old Testament theology are the same as they were for Aaron in Exodus 32. To what extent is the community able to bear the aniconic character of God and the social implications of that character? And to what extent is that dangerous reality compromised in terms of heavenly icon and earthly monopoly? All who participate in this conversation are left to ponder this. For thus says the high and lofty one who inhabits eternity, whose name is holy, I dwell in the high and holy place and also with the one who is of a contrite and humble spirit, to revive the spirit of the humble, to revive the heart of the contrite. If God's name were not so holy, and if God's habitat were not with the humble, our interpretive task would be very different, surely more palatable to the way things are in the world.
We can spend a little bit of time with questions for Dr. Brueggemann.
Yes, I used the word embrace of pain. What I mean is that God has two social functions in the Bible, or anywhere, I submit. One is that God legitimates structure. That is, that means God says this is the way it is. The other thing that God struggles to do is to embrace pain among those who do not benefit from the way life is structured. So that in the Exodus narrative, one might argue that what God does is to authorize Pharaoh to organize the empire. But the other thing that God does is to say, I have heard your cry, and I have come down to deliver you. And what I mean to suggest is that God's heart is kept torn by having to do this legitimating of structure, which gods always have to do, because that's what makes them a god. And the decision of Yahweh against all the other gods in the Near East to embrace pain, because whenever you embrace pain, you're relinquishing a part of the legitimization of the structure. Illustration, you make it very clear that you will accept no late papers. So a late paper comes in. What do? I said I wouldn't accept any late papers. That's my preferred way of handling it. But once in a while, a student is particularly conning. So they say, oh, all right. And by that much, the structure is no longer legitimated, because the word gets around the slave camp very quickly. Or, my sons are no longer living at home, praise the Lord. But, you know, it's the dilemma of every parent with a 17-year-old. What do you do when the 17-year-old promised to come in at 1 and comes in at 3:30? Well, you got two basic tasks. One is to welcome them home and be glad they're not wrapped around a tree somewhere. And the other one is to make it clear that this is intolerable. I always hope that my wife will be awake, because if she will do the one job, that leaves me free to do the other one. But usually she's not, so I must do both. And then it becomes a strategic question about which to do last so that it endures. Now, I mean to suggest that that's the dilemma with which God struggles, because in every occasion, God is deciding what kind of a God to be. I do not believe that it is faithful to the text, taken altogether, to say that God finally decided to embrace pain and to forget about the legitimating of structure. God keeps knowing that both of these tasks have got to be done. And I believe that the debate that always comes up in the church about anything is because we've taken sides on this question. I was in Denver last week. I was at ILF, and the presbytery out there asked me to speak because they've been at war for 10 years. And I healed it. But as near as I can figure it out, and I couldn't figure it out, what the war is about is that a presbytery had a budget. That's what Presbyterians do. And a committee violated the budget to serve some need. And both parties are filled with righteous indignation for 10 years. And that's how we do it. Am I making sense to you? But the point I would want to establish, that any time you embrace pain, by that much the legitimated structure is jeopardized. Which is why Ed Meese, in one of his earlier statements that now in retrospect doesn't look as absurd as some others, That is why Ed Meese had to say there weren't any hungry people. Once you acknowledge that they're hungry people, you have conceded that something isn't working and you can't just keep praying over the system. So that people who are in charge always have to deny the pain, because once the pain is honored by admission, everything is open for grabs again. Which, you know, is why one doesn't want to admit that our marriage is in trouble, because once you concede that, everything's got to change, and so on. You want to comment back? The argument I meant to be making is that icons are characteristically made out of gold and silver, and gold and silver is always the property of people who have the most and are in charge of the social order. And therefore, icons, this is Karl Marx, that icons are a direct articulation of having a social surplus. And if somebody has a social surplus, you can bet it came off of somebody else's table that has been marginalized. So I was wanting to say that making icons is a practice of social inequality that in turn legitimates the social inequality that is derived from the making of icons. What we've got to study is how in the Bible the reality of God and the reality of the social system are so identified that you cannot separate them. And I believe on the whole that in the American church they get separated by liberals and they get separated by conservatives. The classic text, I suspect, is in Jeremiah 22. Where the poet has Yahweh say, Josiah, doesn't name him, but apparently that's it, took care of the poor and the needy. Is this not to know me? Doesn't say if you know Yahweh, you'll do that. Doesn't say if you do that, you'll get to know Yahweh. It says the doing of it is the knowing of Yahweh. A certain social practice is, in fact, a mode of Yahweh's character. And I mean to be arguing that's true for iconic religion and it is true for aniconic religion. Both cases. Okay? Yes. Right. Right. So what you are saying, are you not, is that we really have to learn to reread the New Testament.
Yes.
I agree with that. I will not write such a book like that, but there are very important books like that being written. I will mention the one that has helped me the most lately by Juan Luis Segundo, who is one of the most important of the liberation theologians in Latin America. And I think it's called Jesus in the Synoptic Gospels. Such an innocent title. And I feel sure, I'm not positive, but I feel sure it must be published by Orbis. I think that the pastors and teachers of the church have simply got to learn to do social criticism. We got to learn to do social criticism of the text, not just of the world, but of the text. And what you are describing, I think, is a church that has been so paranoid about Marxist criticism that we've denied ourselves the tools we need to hear the text in our time. So if you are interested in that, the first thing I would do is to get on the mailing list for Orbis Press. They're publishing a book a week that does this stuff, and sometimes three. There is a growing literature about that. Obviously, people who have learned to spiritualize the New Testament will dismiss this literature, but what we have got to begin to do is to get it in the conversation at all. We don't all have to agree with it, but slowly the categories of our conversation begin to shift. And I think that we can be more attentive to how people's categories shift when, for reason of social inversion, haves become have-nots. It is simply astonishing how farmers in Iowa who have been champions of the free market system, out of their pain, have arrived at another view of the world. Now, if we can pastorally help people see that this happens to us, then we can help people see what's going on in the text. But we are in the church, as you suggest, going to have to get some new categories of discernment, or we will not see what is there. And that doesn't mean that the whole Bible must be made a slave to social action. That is as important for pastoral counseling and psychology as it is for the social dimension of our common life. Yes.
Once the have-nots
begin
to have, then they are iconic.
That's right. It's not eternal. It is so until the kingdom comes. Right. Got to cling to that. Right. Oh, one more? Yes.
I appreciated your comments. Puzzles me about him is not simply that he disagrees with the kind of evangelistic fervor with which he disagrees. It's almost a religious impulse. Can you explain that at all?
Well, I think I can, yes. And that is that Karl Marx is right. We have religious fervor about our money. That is, I think that the religious fervor of those voices is because the bishops have gotten very close to the real issues that are both theological and economic, and it gets very dangerous when people begin to show us the linkages in our commodity fetishism, I think. That may be a little bit simple-minded, but that's what I think. Yeah.